Well, hypnotism throws these things into violent re-stimulation by changing the person's viewpoint of time. It gives him the idea that he's not here in present time. It can push him elsewhere. And his elsewheres are all contained in these pictures. So we have a facsimile bank. Let's say here was somebody living who had taken 1,000 of these pictures and he's got the walls plated with them. And you go over and you move him in front of one of these pictures and reduce his awareness and you say, "That's it, fella. There you are." Well, he looks at the picture and says, "Yes, so I am. I'm in 1939 or something like that. You see, this is when he tried to hold a wall from falling down or tried to keep two cars from coming together in 1939. And because they're on his wavelength and so forth, he can look at them and they'll match up and he will actually feel again the pain he felt when those two cars hit each other. How does he do this? Because he used energy in order to prevent something from happening and made thereby and therewith a complete picture, even a moving picture, in that he made a sequence of pictures, you see. And having made these pictures, he has in them, of course, everything that was present in the scene, simply because he was resisting the scene. Now let's take somebody who burns his finger on a stove. He comes along and he puts his finger on the hot stove and he pulls it off again. Well, the moment he pulls it off, he is, of course, pulling hard. When he tries to push his hand away from the hot stove, he carries a hot piece of stove on his finger for some little time. See, it's real, real remarkable how he would do this. And the proof of it is can you do anything about a burn or about an automobile accident, which has happened in the past? Yes, you can. You can simply to get him to duplicate what he refused to duplicate in the past. And when he duplicates it again, it, of course, blows up because he stops resisting it. And because there isn't anything there, his resistance alone was all that kept it in restimulation. So as a net result, somebody burns his finger on a stove, you actually have him apply hot stoves to his finger for a while and apply burned fingers to his hand for a while. You know, just mock them up and put them there, energy pictures, put some more there and some more there and some more there, and all of a sudden, boof, and the burn heals up right away. I've seen a burn which should have gone into a second-degree burn heal up in a matter of about half an hour. Blisters gone and everything else, just on the application of this principle. Well, these are the pictures which give forth the commands. When an individual looks at them, they start to dissolve or go into action. See? He chips away some of them. And when he chips away some of them, the energy hits him anew. He resists it anew, and he builds up a picture of the picture. See? So you start to look around at the engram bank and you pick up pains, commands, voices, crashes, heat, saline solutions, anything, everything that was resisted in the past, anything. When you look at it again, it goes into restimulation. Now, worse than that, a person gets so confused after a while about doing this that when he looks around the room and sees a picture of a wall, this, of course, makes him duplicate with the picture of the wall which he had before, a wall which he tried to keep from falling down. So he looks at the wall and gets a pain. But, of course, that wall is not hitting him. It's not hurting him. Oh, yes, it is, he'll tell you, if you really made him spot it. No, it's not that wall. It's another wall. He's made a slight mistake. He's unwilling to duplicate this exact wall. He's using some old picture. See, he picked up the old picture and says, "Look, communication. All right, I can echo this wall. I can make an exact duplicate of this wall. I'll pick up this facsimile, this old energy sheet, and hold it up in front of the wall, and we will get a perfect duplicate. Only we don't." And there is the mechanism, you might say, of restimulation and engrams. This came out directly, really, out of a study of hypnotism and a study of the mind and general observation. How many things can you do to these pictures? Well, boy, you can do an awful lot of these things. You find out a long time ago that somebody in psychology wrote a book called Eidetic Recall. It shows the searching observational quality of a mole who is very dead. There are at least 55 perceptions in these energy pictures. at least 55 perceptions. That's an awful lot of perceptions. When you look up in the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I was just praising before, you find out that there are five. There aren't five, there's 55. There's all sorts of interesting perceptions. They say, well, the perceptions of the individual are sight, hearing, smell, the touch, and organic sensation. Well, let's just throw the dictionary away and take the vocabulary of a babu and say, now this is the English language. You're just not going to get there on that basis, because it wouldn't explain. You see, if they'd really looked and taken a look at lookingness, they would have found there was heat in these things. Thermal. One of the most important things in them. Thermal. How do you suppose a kid gets a fever? What is fever? What's pain? Well, pain, of course, is just a stored conflict of sensations, which are so conflicting that it's impossible to differentiate, and so an individual just backs up off of them. This is pain. As far as fever is concerned, it's simply a thermal. The fellow's got a lot of hot pictures. That's all. In processing somebody, I had a medical doctor. He saw his opportunity to wreck a preclear, so he really dived in. I was processing a preclear, and the preclear was just doing fine, running an engram and just doing fine. And all of a sudden, the medical doctor walked over and said, let me take his temperature. I said, it's all right. And the doctor took his temperature and found out that he was running a temperature of 104 and said, this man will have to go to bed immediately. I just can't permit this to go on. And I said, you can't permit this to go on. Sit down in that chair. And in a few minutes, having run out the engram, the preclear's temperature was 98.6. And this doctor sat there stunned. He had seen a 104 degree temperature turned on and turned off by artificial means, which is to say just a guy talking to another guy. I finally told him the next day he couldn't do it again. So he had a temperature of 104 very shortly, very immediately. And I let him go to bed. Next day, when he was feeling a little bit better and wasn't coughing quite so hard and so forth, I said, well, it's a good idea when you're running an engram to run them out, all the way out. He never forgot the lesson. He became obsessed on running the engrams all the way out. Well, here's a quick look at the anatomy of this mind. Now, how many interpretations had been given this? Of course, what we're giving it is a mechanical interpretation. Don't lose sight of that. But it's a very, very good interpretation in that you can see what somebody else can see. You don't have to have seven opinions on somebody else's seven opinions. And the main test of it is, can you make somebody well? Yes, you can. Now, if we just had that and we were just studying that mechanism, why, we'd be all right. We'd be a couple thousand years ahead of the crowd. We would. Just the anatomy of pictures and how you erase them and how you take care of the preclear and bring him back up the line. But there'd be a lot of cases we couldn't clip. There'd be a lot of cases we couldn't do anything for, simply because their pictures are so smashed in and so disarranged that they can no longer differentiate between one picture and another picture. So picture therapy, you might say, as you would have called Dianetics, picture therapy is not universally applicable. It hits at the outside. Probably 50%. Of course, that's pretty good, but that's not good enough. Because in the first place, we're not really trying for just a broad psychotherapy. We're not really trying for that. We're trying for a lot of other things. We're trying for a greater freedom. We're trying for some test of rationality, which would be sufficient just to know, let you know whether or not an atom bomb would be safe in a president's hands or not. We're trying for a lot of things. So picture therapy, let's make them well, we can turn off chronic somatics and so forth. This is not a total effectiveness. Now, we've got to go on someplace else. Well, years went along and wars went along and a lot of things happened, but most important of these things was the realization that there was something very, very haywire with time. Something very, very wrong with time. There is no physicist definition for time. Time is rate of change of particles in space, which is the same as saying time is time. You're actually defining it by itself. You're saying rate of change. Rate is something that includes the word time. When you define rate, you find out you've said the same thing again. It's not an adequate definition, so therefore, if we're to go on in the field of physics at all, we certainly have to go back and pick up the other thing the Encyclopedia Britannica said, which was simply this. Time and space are the problem of the psychologist. Okay, if they're a problem of the psychologist, we better go in for this. Well, I started defining time, fooling around with time, trying to do something about it, and ran into the fact that there was a barrier on its definition. One first had to know what space was. Well, this was a shocker, having to know what space was. This is too much. Because here I found Newton and the rest of the boys so silent. Oh, the oppressive, doom-like silence entirely through the field of philosophy and physics and everything else on what space is. What space? Well, sure, we know what space is. It's around us all the time. It's big cubes or something, isn't it? Oh, yeah. Because space behaves in a crazy fashion. The second you begin to exceed the speed of light, space starts doing peculiar things. Space isn't a constant. The moment you walked into nuclear physics, any earlier concept of space ceased to be adequate because space is... it just goes to pieces. Speed of light. The second you go above the speed of light, of course, if you're using messed universe waves, you go above the speed of perception. So if you go above the speed of perception, why, naturally, inevitably, space is going to go by the boards. You see that? The second that you exceed the speed of perception, you're going to exceed space. Lord knows what'll happen. It's not predictable then, simply because there aren't adequate postulates to cover this situation. Adequate postulates, not adequate definitions, it finally works out. A fellow hasn't made up his mind what he ought to have happen now after he's going the speed of light. Now what should he have happen? He'd have to make a brand new series of postulates. He'd find out, however, that they would stick, these new postulates. He could do whatever he wanted with these new postulates because he's not in an agreed-upon field even vaguely. He's not even vaguely limited. Second, you exceed the speed of a photon, you naturally exceed the agreement of space. So you could make any kind of new postulate you want to. If you're depending upon photons to tell you that the dimension is there, you know, if you're going to see with photons, why, then you see the speed of light and your definition of space is just up to you. Make up your mind. What's it going to be? Space above the speed of light is octagonally quadruped. Anything you want. Of course, there's nothing sounds sillier than a physicist trying to theorize when he gets above the speed of light, naturally, because he depends utterly for his vision and perception upon photons. And depending utterly upon photons, naturally, voila, we have no space above that speed of space. What's the speed of light? The speed of space. Now, let's not be very deep and complex. Let's find out if there's anything else missing around here besides the definition of space. Yes, there sure is. There are two other things which are misdefined. And one of those things is a very simple thing. A static. What is a static? Well, a static is something that's motionless, of course. Oh, my. Are we going to be this theoretical? What do you mean, theoretical? A static is something which is in an equilibrium of forces. Now, every once in a while, you're going to meet an engineer or somebody, and he's going to say, you're going to say static, and he's going to say, yes, a static, and all of a sudden give you a terrible argument. Why is he going to give you an argument? Because he's going to say, well, look, you see that package there? That's a static. It's in an equilibrium of forces. What do you mean? We didn't have a definition for a static. That's equilibrium force. That's there. It's motionless. Oh, yes. By what theoretical means do we consider that package motionless? By its own definitions, that package is traveling in eight directions. One direction alone, it's traveling at 1,000 miles an hour through space. That's the speed of the Earth. It's not in an equilibrium of forces then. It's traveling in one direction alone, 1,000 miles an hour, and then there's the speed of the orbital speed, besides the rotational speed, and then there's the speed of the solar system itself, and oh boy, there are more speeds. There are eight speeds just because of Earth and the solar system that this thing is taking. This is in about the maddest state of motion you ever heard of anything being in by physical definition. In other words, there is no such thing as something in an equilibrium of forces except a theoretical thing. You couldn't have anything on this Earth in an equilibrium of forces. So therefore, that is a limited definition. And it's not an adequate definition. So if it's not an adequate definition, for heaven's sakes, what is a static? Well, static would have to be something which was not located in space, which had no mass, which had no wavelength, and had no position in time. In other words, let's reduce it all the way down. Second I'd reduced it all the way down, I found I had a definition for zero. And I never realized it before, but the real wild variable in this universe is zero. Your mathematician happily slaps zero into all of his equations. Your arithmetic teacher stands up there and handles zero just as though she was handling something that was secure and sound as the Empire State Building. Everybody is saying this good old solid friend of ours, zero. And yet they knew in algebra that whenever they divided by zero or multiplied by zero, everything went to hell. They know this, and yet they're saying there's zero. Well, your boy working quantum mechanics down in the laboratory, every time he puts a zero in an equation, he introduces into it a wild variable, and this alone really is enough to account for all the bugger factors you have to use to get quantum mechanics to balance. Zero, it's a wild variable. What do you mean, wild variable? Zero, zero. Well, we'll have to define zero for the first time we get a definition for zero. Now, we're at the threshold of mathematics and physics. With that definition of zero, we're standing there with mathematics and physics grouped together for the first time. We find out that zero, to be zero, couldn't have an... We already had a static. Well, we found that we were defining zero. All right? It couldn't have a position. Couldn't have a position in space. Because it would be a qualified zero then. It would have... The second you gave it a location, you would say the zero at Hollywood and Vine. See, that would be a qualified zero. Well, we'd have to say the zero at Hollywood and Vine when? To really qualify the zero. And then, at Hollywood and Vine when, but a zero of what? In other words, every time you put a zero into a mathematical equation, you would have to add a paragraph onto it to say a zero of what, where, and at what time. Your teacher of arithmetic does this all the time. She says, well, two apples subtracted from two apples give you zero. But it's understood, you see, zero apples. Well, of course, that's not real good. That's very, very theoretical. You say, zero apples where? Well, on the blackboard. Ha, she's answered all of the qualifications for having put down zero to keep it from being a wild variable. But the second it's allowed to float without adequate definition. She said a zero of apples on the blackboard right now, all right, qualified. But does she put down a zero of apples right now on the blackboard or ever mention this to her class? No, she does not. She said that's zero, that's good old solid zero. You see, it looks like an egg stood on end. And that's just where mathematics laid an egg. They had no definition for zero. Zero would have to be without a place in time, without a connotation of condition or quantity. That is to say, it couldn't be a zero of something to have an absolute zero. You just have a zero, not a zero of apples or a zero of this and that. And a time. You couldn't have any time in it. Because you see, the second that you allow one of these conditions to exist in it, becomes variable. It becomes variable because you have permitted to sit in that zero an inarticulate condition. You know, 2 minus 2 equals 0. That's not good enough. I'm saying this. Of course, the sound waves of it are right here, but it's not a zero of anything. So we divide by 0, we can get 0 equals 1. We can get 0 equals this, 0 equals that. This is one of the most confounding problems of the mathematician. A zero has to be without position in space, without position in any space, without a location in time, must contain no actual or understood mass, and no actual or understood wavelength, and then zero. No mass, no wavelength, no time, no location in space, and we've got zero. The second we permit one of these things to exist in it as a condition, we no longer have zero. We have an understood somethingness which happens to be absent at the momentness which we have to mention. And there is where mathematics have been falling on their faces. Mathematics only work very finitely. They're easily exceeded. All right. What other thing would we have to know to solve this? Well, we'd have to know a little bit more about space. Now we've got a zero. For the first time, we've got a zero. We've got a nothingness. What is nothingness? It's without time. And boy, you better know this. Without time, no past, present, or future. This nothingness has no past, present, or future. It has no location in space. It has no wavelength. It has no mass. See? Zero. And we're looking right straight into the teeth of what life is. It is something which is not located in space, which has no real position in time, which has no inherent wavelength, and which has no mass. That's life. And that's why it's incomprehensible and can never be equated by earlier formulations. Because everybody was locating it someplace and then forgetting that they had located it anyway. They were attributing energies and masses to it, and then never saying they were contributing masses or energy to it, but the energies and the masses were the thing. So we have the answer to the smallest wavelength of thought, don't we? That's a long communication lag. I'm ashamed of it. 25 years. Ask a question in 1932, and I get it answered about 23, 24 years later. But that's because the answer was so darn obvious. It's the obvious answer that's always the useful one. An individual could not be something composed of energy, object, so forth. We got space nailed down right there. If life does not have to have a position in space to be alive. Of course, we're looking at what space is, which is what it is, a viewpoint of dimension. Here is something without wavelength, without energy, without mass, which can yet assume that there is a dimension. And assuming that there's a dimension, it can then utilize energy and perceive. It's remarkable. That tells you why an individual, when he's exteriorized, can be in this room and be on Mars. Bing, bing. He isn't in this room, and he isn't on Mars. There is no mass or energy moving from this room to Mars. And back here again, see? There isn't any energy motion. And all he's got to do is just assume a new viewpoint. Bang, bang. Every time he assumes a new viewpoint, he can have a new space, too. And if you get somebody beautifully exteriorized, why, he can assume viewpoints of 18 planets that aren't there. The only difference is he's got to know he's assuming the viewpoints. That is different than other people's viewpoint. When he assumes one, that's different than other people's viewpoints. He can see a much more beautiful universe than this universe right here, simply by assuming its existence and taking a viewpoint of it. assumes it exists and looks at it. So it's there. And out of this horrible mass of data called physics and psychology and the rest of it, we get down to the most simple simplicity there is, which is the fact that life does not have mass. Boy, know this, please. Don't ever make a mistake on this. Life does not have wavelength. It does not have mass. It has no position in time. It has no location in space. Because time, space, energy, mass are all conditional postulates which units of life have agreed on with units of life. And so we got a universe. Every one of these things is conditional to the ability of life to make a postulate and make it stick. Viewpoint of dimension. When you first entered the messed universe, it looked like a vast and terrific secret. There was some enormous secret connected with the messed universe. Here it was. And yet, what was easier? Somebody told you about the messed universe. You had to assume that somebody was telling you about something in the first place. And he told you, communicated to you about the messed universe, or you communicated to yourself about the messed universe. And the next thing you knew, you were able to bridge a gap and communicate with some other unit or some other individual, unit of life or individual, about what they were seeing in the messed universe. You find out the first entrance engram into the messed universe is a tremendous argument concerning the messed universe itself, in which you lose. If you hadn't lost that argument, you wouldn't be looking at it now. You see that? You never would have seen it at all. What an interesting trick. You had to buy somebody else's viewpoint before you could view it. In other words, we're dealing then with problems in universes. There's your universe, everybody else's universe. There's the messed universe, and other universes. But the first condition of the universe is that one have a viewpoint and assume there's a dimension. So this problem wraps itself up pretty tight. The PAT phrase that resolves all this is, where are our viewpoints safe? In other words, where are viewpoints, my own or others, doesn't matter, where are these viewpoints surviving that I can do nothing about? Because as long as other viewpoints survive that you can do nothing about, there's going to be space you can do nothing about, and therefore objects that you can do nothing about, and energy you can do nothing about, and everything is safe because you're no longer dangerous to anything. There's space. That's why a kid runs away from home, runs away from mom and papa, and so forth. It's their space, their viewpoints. Just a viewpoint is enough to have space, to have a universe. So we split up these universes. How do you tear these universes apart and straighten the pre-clear out and square the whole problem up all the way down the line, including physics and the atom bomb? It's where our viewpoint's safe. And you, of course, will blow up space in all directions. Still, an individual can make and tailor space or agree with it and disagree with it at will. And all you're trying to return to the pre-clear is to be able to do it at will, not on somebody else's will. Okay.